John Homans remembers that his childhood dog ran freely without a leash, slept outside, spent most of her time happily exploring the yard. She was a companion, but not exactly a member of the family. So when he adopted Stella, a Labrador mix from a shelter, as a birthday present for his son, the images from his youth were strongly imprinted in his mind. The neighbors on his New York City block lavished expensive clothing, doggy birthday cakes, and $1,000 medical treatments on their dogs. Homans was determined to draw a boundary, but he soon found himself treating Stella like a person, trying to decipher her emotions and questioning her diet and exercise. In the new book, Homans gives us an intriguing look into the life of dogs. The new book, What's a Dog For? The Surprising History, Science, Philosophy, and Politics of Man's Best Friend. John Homans, welcome to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
What brought you to all of these questions? When we talk about history and science and philosophy and politics, there's a lot there.
It's true. There is a true thing about my book is there is a lot in it. But you know, I think if someone had if we'd learned that a neighbor when I was growing up had been sleeping with their dog, someone would have called a vice squad. But now, you know, dogs are in everyone's beds. Stella doesn't sleep in our bed, and it just seemed like a very different world when I thought my childhood wasn't complete without having a dog. So when my son was 10, we went out to the shelter, the North Shore Animal League, and picked up Stella, which is a beautiful, you know, lab mix. And interestingly, she was from Tennessee, and I wondered about that. And, you know, and I began to go on the internet and learn about dogs, and I found that it's this fantastically rich and conflicted and vivid world of politics and science, and I just became fascinated with it, and you know, starting from Stella, I, you know, went out off into these you know, different directions. It was she sort of led me around through this wilderness and kind of showed me the way, which was a lot of fun, actually.
As you point out in the book, our association, humans' association with dogs, is at least 15,000 years old. But when you look at the changes, that is relatively new, isn't it?
Which is new.
The changes that we have seen in the relationship and the closeness.
Yeah, I mean, I think the personhood. Dogs are treated much more like people, than they were when I was growing up. I mean, not that we didn't love our dog, but it was just the dog's world was more outdoors. It was off the leash. We didn't think about spaying them. We wouldn't think of they barely went to the vet, our dogs, and whereas you know, people can spend here in New York City, you can spend $10,000 or $15,000 treating a dog's medical condition with machines and equipment that are every bit as good as for humans. So that's really, it's a very different world. And some people have James Serple, who's down at UPenn and is a scholar of dogs, thinks that the reason that there are more dogs than ever now, he suggested that one of the reasons is that as human families and social organizations have frayed, and this, you know, the book Bowling Alone, as people have lived more separate lives, dogs have, you know, been more useful in providing people their social support, and I think that is clearly true. And also, you know, we just like them.
They're cute.
Yeah.
You do talk in the book about that innate ability that they have to communicate with us by responding to our cues.
Right.
We point a lot, and they get that.
Well, it's true that the one of the findings, and it's still a very disputed finding, as along with everything else in the dog world, is that a dog can understand a human point. And where a wolf wouldn't be able to, and interestingly, a chimpanzee, which is much, much smarter than a dog in any kind of and most objective measures of intelligence, can't understand a human point. And so these scientists have suggested that this is because there's something about tameness, there's something about the ability to understand another creature as a helper rather than as a competitor that allows them to understand the point. And the reason the scientists are so interested in this quality is that, you know, humans must have evolved a quality something like this, that part of what makes us humans, rather than primates, well, we are primates, but rather than chimpanzees or our closest ancestor, is that we also are tame, and we understand that another creature is ready to be, it might want to help us. And in fact, the first linguistic gesture that a baby makes is to point at about a year old. And the dog's ability is, these scientists think, an analogy to this human ability, and it's something that we share. So then that's one. It's the clearest indication of why they're so suitable for life with humans. Although there are lots of others,
and we can talk about some of those in a moment. But it fascinates me because you talk in the book, obviously, about what we get from the dog, but also what the dog gets from us. I mean, it is a mutually beneficial relationship.
Absolutely. Well, there are some people who think that there are some scientists who think that the dog is what they know as a social parasite. That they've moved like a bird that lays its egg in another bird's nest. It's figured out a way to activate our caring responses in order to get fed, and think that that's the relationship sort of is as simple as that. And that's the dogs certainly, you know, dogs evolved to fit into a niche that involved humans. And this is what these scientists, this is the cornerstone of these canine sciences ideas, is that the dog evolved to live with people. So, sure, they get a lot from us. But I think that there is a mutuality to the relationship. I tend to believe, and this may be sentimental, that we're both gaining quite a bit. At least I do. So.
Well, certainly, and there's that emotional connection. But as far as being a social parasite, I mean, that really can be said about any human relationship in some way, shape, or form, right?
Right. Well, sure. That's the thing. I think that I think he was trying to pull people's chains by saying that because dog owners are, it's easy to pull dog people's chains. I know from experience.
I'm sure you do. I'm sure you do. When you write a book like this and on that subject, what is it about the subject that is so fraught with passionate responses from people, from everything about, you know, you are, people look down on you if you go to a breeder instead of a rescue a dog from a shelter. There are the politics of it. There is an awful lot about how you train the dog, how you raise the dog, and there's a lot. People are very passionate.
Well,
in
but
the
dogs, because
way.
Dogs are, it's, a dog is like a mirror. I mean, in small and large ways, a dog is always, you know, in the whole culture of dogs reflects human culture, and dogs have evolved to reflect humans somehow. And you know, and it's the simplest example of this is that dogs look like their owners, and often they do. And dogs reflect how someone wants to be seen. I mean, for instance, with Stella, you know, Labradors were bred by, you know, the richest people in England, and they wanted these great servants, these dogs that were very, very trainable, that were not ostentatious, and that didn't look like other people's hunting dogs. And that's how, and so the dog was really a reflection of some of the ideas of these British aristocrats. And a dog that, or if you talk about pit bulls, you know, there's just a bitter dispute about pit bulls, and I love pit bulls. But it's a fact that there are more, that the pit bull shelter in Manhattan on 110th Street the main animal control shelter in the city, is often 90% or more pit bulls. Those are the dogs that end up on death row. And, you know, and there's a big, pit bull lovers say they're great dogs, and then there are people who think that they're too aggressive. I tend to think that they're great dogs, but there are too many of them. And they're not, they're the last dogs that are, you know, being living essentially like my dogs of my childhood, off the leash and without being spayed or neutered. They're often dogs of the poor. They're people make money by selling them and that in the inner city, and you know, and that's a big problem in the dog world. But I think dogs are always reflect in many ways, and that's what the book is about. It's reflect human culture and are just inextricable from the human story. And that's what I found. That's what I was most exciting to me about writing the book. And of course, Stella is inextricable from my story now.
So I would think that writing a book like this and investigating and having this dog at your feet while you're doing it really does strengthen that bond more perhaps than it would if you hadn't written the book.
Well, it's true. It made me, obviously, I know a lot more about who she is and what she is. But it one question I had when I started the book was, what is this relationship about? Why am I friends with this creature? Or am I even friends with this creature? Or is this some kind of, I mean, not social parasite, but is this some kind of trickery? Or am I deceiving myself? And when I finished, I thought, okay, I understand why this creature is my friend. I mean, my companion and my friend. And what had been confusing, is this a person or is this, what is this? I sort of brought all those ideas into balance, which was satisfying. And also, you know, she likes being famous. Well, she doesn't know she's famous, but...
Yeah, they like that. Well, any attention, right? I was reading your book, getting ready for this interview last night, and I was my dog Brady, who's a big chuckle-headed yellow lab, was sitting next to me, and seemed agitated. You know, seemed like something was going on, and I didn't know what was happening. And sort of pacing back and forth, and I just wasn't sure. And I took his head in my hands, and I looked at him. I said, "You know, buddy, I wish you could tell me what's on your mind." And then I thought about it for a second. I said, you know, but I think if you started talking, you wouldn't shut up.
I know, there's that with certain dogs. They wouldn't, and some don't shut up, but you
right.
can hear them. Now, Stella likes to hold forth quite loudly in the dog run, but at home she's fairly quiet. So
I don't have a big barking problem with my dog, but they just look like they have a lot to tell you.
No, it's
you
true.
Know,
and
you
know, yeah, a golden is like that with those eyes and sort of that
furrowed brow.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, the book is endlessly fascinating and lovely, and it's a great story about you and Stella as well. What's a Dog For? The Surprising History, Science, Philosophy, and Politics of a Man's Best Friend. The book is published by the Penguin Press. John Homans, thank you very much for being with us. Always
a
pleasure.
Thanks so much, Josh.
Thanks so much.
Joe.
Again,
yeah.
John
yeah.
is the executive editor of New York Magazine, has been since 1994. The new book, What's a Dog For?, published by the Penguin Press. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.